This is the last opportunity I'll have to tell stories, at least this round, and probably not anymore during the 50th anniversary. But it's been a lot of fun. I was up here in July and had three sessions, and then these two now. So I really appreciate Hoban inviting me back, and especially Chuck and Stephanie Carpenter for their kindness in making me feel welcome after 20 years up here. And then, you know, it's like anything when you're involved in a project for a long time, and this was 20 years of my working life and living life, and it's a major portion of even our family. And Jeff, our son, is up here with me this time, and he doesn't get back too frequently, but values the experience he had up here. He was born in Chelan, came up here at 6 days old in a sled behind a snowmobile, and then lived the first 9 years of his life here. Our daughter, Christy, came. She was born in October, so she didn't come up in the snow, but I think she came up when she was 7 years old, and 7 days old. And then, thank you. And so glad that Jeff could accompany me on this trip and be a part of the celebration here too. So just a very brief introduction in case some of you don't know me. My name is Werner Jansen, and I was manager up here from 1963 to 83, and actually started working with Holden on a volunteer basis in 1961 on some committees in Seattle when they just were starting up, and they were asking for volunteers to help with fundraising and publicity and ideas of Holden and so forth. So I got involved quite early with Holden. And in fact, the flatbed truck down here that they had a sign in front of for the Forerunners, that was my first transportation up here in September of 1961 when we dedicated the diesel electric plants. And when I came up here, of course, I fell in love with the mountains and the place, and was intrigued with the whole idea of the ministry, and basically that's how I got involved. I actually have a degree in aeronautical engineering and was with Boeing for a few years in applied research, and I took a leave of absence in 1963 to come up here and as a volunteer first, and I was assigned to be the coordinator for the kitchen or the something with the kitchen. I can't even remember what it was, and I don't remember what I did, but I remember it was an impressive summer. But I'm going to sort of rush through some little stories. Oh, thank you. I'll rush through some bits of stories here, I'll be here until tomorrow noon or afternoon when the bus leaves, so if you have some questions or if you want an expanded on any of the stories, I'm glad to do it. Somebody asked me, because they advertised that I was going to talk about the Jerusalem artichokes, which I wasn't planning on doing, but very briefly, we've always had challenges with the sewage system up here. Now I think they have a very good functioning sewage system, but in the early days we had a real challenge. So we were trying to come up with a solution for that. We were trying to come up with a solution for the dust on the tailings, and we were trying to come up a solution with fuel for our vehicles, since all of that has to be barged up lake. So I discovered that Jerusalem artichokes would grow well in a variety of pH soils, very acid and very basic. And so we actually tested it out with some donations of Jerusalem artichoke roots from the WSU research station in Prosser, Washington. And we had 800 tubers growing up on the tailings and being sprinkled by sewage out of our sewage lagoons, and it not only solved the dust problem in that test area, but we had Jerusalem artichokes that were growing 8 foot high. And we had a donation from a very generous young man in Minneapolis that when he heard about this project, he handed me a check for $2,500 and said, buy a still, because the reason that we were doing this is Jerusalem artichokes are, the stalk is high in sugar, the tuber is high in starch, and so you can make ethanol alcohol very easily out of Jerusalem artichoke. So that's what our plan was, to distill ethanol alcohol and then use it in the garbage truck and some of the other trucks that, you know, were just for local traffic here. And that was about the time that I retired from here, and then they I guess they weren't as enthusiastic about the project as I was. So it never did go through, but it's an interesting part of the Holden history. Another very, I don't think this one probably has been talked about at all, but, you know, there was a brothel. You know what a brothel is, don't you?
No.
I don't want to go into detail. But during the mining days, and this was related to me in a story, so I never did check it out totally, but it seemed reasonable that just maybe about a half a mile up the shoreline on the south shore from Lucerne, and I did go up there and see the foundation of an old house, and it had a garage built right along the lake so that a boat would go right into the garage, and then there was originally a house built on top of that. And what I was told was that this was the brothel that the miners made use of on times that they had available, and there was somebody that would row them in a rowboat from Lucerne up there, and then they would walk back on a path to Lucerne and I guess take a ride up to come up here to the village. But it actually existed, and a number of people told me about it, so I assumed that it was true. Also, Holden had a small ski area at one point. They had a rope tow that was developed above the miners' village, which was also known as Winston Camp. It was to the north and west of the Winston Camp, and it was a rope tow that went up the mountain, and they put it together with, you know, old Model A wheels and a rope and an engine that they had, and the fellow that I was told that operated and put it together later became the manager of Stevens Pass Ski Area after he left here after the mine closed down, that he became the manager up there. This afternoon I noticed that a jet flew through the valley. I don't know if you saw that or not. It reminded me that in the earlier days we'd have Navy jets that would come really low through the valley here. I mean, it was really disturbing, and it wasn't just once, it was several times a week. So finally, when I was down lake one time, I called Woodley Island Naval Air Base and, you know, talked to the operator, and I said, you know, I don't know if it's your jets or not, but we want it stopped. And they were very nice about it. And the person, I think they referred me to somebody and said that what it was that Navy jets were on practice routes out of Woodley Island Naval Air Station and would fly to eastern Washington, and then they would attempt to get back to the Naval Air Station under radar, undetected. And so it was a frequent test that the pilots went through as to how close they could get to the Naval Air Station without being detected by radar. So they would either fly up Lake Chelan and go in the Stehekin Valley and then try to get into the Whidbey Island that way, or come through here and sneak into the Whidbey Island area. And they actually, you know, were very nice about it. They said that they didn't realize that they were disturbing us, and they would either minimize it or they would stop using this as a training flight. So that just reminded me when the jet flew through here. The other thing when I was just walking around was I noticed the lift down here, which is a little coffee house. And we started that while I was up here, and it was designed like a coffee house so we could have a little entertainment, and actually we had frozen pizzas because we wanted to have sort of evening activities, you know, for people to do besides the snack shop. And so we opened that, and that room originally was the refinishing area for the bowling alley pins. During the mining days, all the bowling alley pins were wooden, and now they're plastic or some composite material. But during that time that they were wooden, and so they had to be refinished, repainted and sanded and so forth, and rebalanced, and that's where they did all that. And we hadn't used that area, but you could still smell the lacquer and so forth, you know, that was in that area. And we sort of cleaned it up and put in the booths and the benches and the little snack area. And we did have pizza down there for a while, and I don't know what they're serving now, but we also had lots of peanuts, and we encouraged people to throw the peanuts on the floor and, you know, to give it more ambiance. And so it was but originally that was during the mining days. It was a refinishing area for the bowling alley. The covered bridge down here, I don't know, of course now with remediation that you can't even, you can go on the bridge, but you can't go across the bridge. And during the mining days, the mine had a covered bridge there, which the top fell off before I ever arrived here in 1961, but we saw pictures of it. And when the bridge that was there needed replacement, we contacted a volunteer. I think his name was Les Erickson. If some of you are from Linwood, Washington, I think he was the city manager or the city engineer for the city of Linwood. And he volunteered to design the bridge since he was an engineer and could sign the documents. And then all of the materials that were was in the bridge was right from here. The logs that formed the main part of the bridge and all the timbers and so forth, that was all cut here. So it basically, and I think it's, I don't know, I forgot to look and see if it's still a shake roof on there, but we even cut the shakes, you know, for the roof of the bridge and try to make it as close to the original as we saw pictures from the mine days. And one day I got a letter from the Oregon Historical Society, and it was the covered bridge branch. And the letter stated that, you know, they were glad that there was, they found another covered bridge in the Northwest because I guess most of them, I mean, there aren't that many in Washington and Oregon. And so they even sent representatives up here to take pictures. And there was a story, and I think the Oregon Historical Society, what journal or whatever it was, about this covered bridge at Holden. And I told him, well, it's not new. I mean, it's not old. It has historical significance, but it's a brand new bridge. And they said, that doesn't make any difference. It's a covered bridge, and we love covered bridges, and we're glad you did it. And so they all gathered for pictures. And I personally hope that I've heard that they might replace it because it's sagging a little bit. I don't think it's sagging enough to replace it, but that's not up to me anymore, so I won't worry about it.
Say, Werner, what year was that? Do you remember?
I can't hear very well.
What year was that?
I think it was like 1970 or 71. I have it written down at home, but I don't.
Okay.
It's getting old, but it's, aren't we all, so. Wes Priebe is, of course, a saint and an institution for anybody who knows anything about Holden. But I knew him quite well because he lived in Seattle. First he went to LBI, and then he was involved in here in the very earliest days. And then he sort of disappeared for a while. He went down to work in the missions down at an Indian reservation in Nevada, I think. And then he didn't come back, and I think he felt like he wasn't really welcome because nobody really invited him back and so forth. And when we had our office, when I started working, the first office was in Ballard for Holden Village, and he lived in Ballard. So anytime I would come up here, I would also give him a call and ask him if he wanted to come up to Holden with me, and which he always did. So we had a lot of car trips, you know, going across the pass from Seattle to hear all of his stories. But to understand Wes, he wasn't an entrepreneur that studied this area and decided that, you know, this mine would be a great, you know, place to have a retreat. But you have to understand that about the same time as he was writing the letters to the Howe Sound Company, he was also bidding on a destroyer battleship in Lake Union in Seattle. And when he told me about this, I said, what in the world are you going to do with that? Well, I don't know, but he said he doesn't think it's in very good shape and probably nobody will bid on it, so he bid a dollar, he said. And he thought maybe he would get it and then he'd figure out what to do. And a couple years later, he said that he'd just gotten a letter from the Lone Star Brewery in Texas that they were abandoning their executive retreat someplace in Texas that must have trees. I think there's places in Texas that have trees. And so he was negotiating with them on maybe taking over this executive retreat and of the Lone Star Brewery in Texas. And And then he told me a short time later that he also had correspondence with some outfit in California that owned a small castle. It wasn't San Simeon, I'm sure, but it was a small castle, he said, and they were very interested in negotiating to give it to a nonprofit organization. So you have to understand that Holden was one of the many, many things that Wes looked at for a possible something. You know, I mean, I don't think he thought too much beyond just the excitement of making contact for a gift and going ahead with it. So, but this was sort of his life. I mean, this was the miracle of Wes Preeb, and this one happened to work for him. So we're forever thankful to Wes Preeb that this one was successful. But I also wanted to mention that there were a lot of people that generally aren't mentioned in terms of Holden Village. And one of them, I think one of the unique stories is the Gordon Stewart, who most of you probably have never heard of. He used to live at Dompty Lake. People thought he was a hermit, but he wasn't a hermit. He lived up there all by himself for 40 years, which makes him suspiciously a hermit, but we knew him quite well, and he was marvelously ready. He got the Wall Street Journal, you know, every week, and he invested his money, and he was not a rich person, but he had friends that were investors and really helped him out. But when he worked for the Forest Service, he had a cleft lip, and so and he didn't have a, that he was ranger at Lucerne, and he wanted to continue working with the Forest Service, and it was right at that time that they were bringing in college-educated people to work with the Forest Service and replace the people that really knew what they were doing. I don't know if anybody's from the Forest Service. So basically, that's why he then went up to Dompty Lake. But when he was ranger down at Lucerne, and I think it was, I'm just guessing at the dates, but like 1935, 36, maybe 34, that there was a fire in Copper Basin. And this was when Howe Sound was doing exploratory work in the mine, and they hadn't gone into a development phase yet. And there was a big fire in Copper Basin, which burned quite a bit of timber. And the Forest Service was coming up to serve a warrant to the exploratory engineer that was working for Howe Sound and going to present him a bill for $50,000 to cover the cost of this fire. And Gordon Stewart brought them up as he was the district, he was the ranger at Lucerne, and he brought them up on horseback on the old trail on the south side of the ridge. And when he was coming into the fire area, he found a tree that had been hit by lightning. And so he pointed this out to the supervisor, the district supervisor, and you know, they decided right there that it wasn't the fault of Howe Sound Company, who they assumed it was their fault. And they said they rode down into the village and presented, I mean, they told the engineer that how close they had come to receiving this bill for $50,000. And he said, well, if we would have received this bill, we would have pulled out, because the mine was so marginal in terms of making money over a 20-year period that an extra $50,000 now would just, you know, destroy even the hope that they would stay here. So, you know, in a sense, Gordon Stewart is sort of like Wes Preeb, that through his finding this lightning strike, that he was an individual that really allowed Howe Sound to go ahead with the mining operation. And there were a lot of people like this in terms of the Holden history. Lou and Jerry Sheffield they had big wheat farms in eastern Washington, Wilbur, Washington, and also in Montana. And they were the ones that Gil Berg got acquainted with them, and they were the ones that found the hydro equipment that we still use now. They found it in an irrigation project over in Idaho, and they went over and bought this equipment for $1,500 and then gave it to Holden. And so that the hydro equipment that we're using now was originally purchased for $1,500, given to Holden, and then we installed it with the help of another marvelous person, which never is mentioned. Henry Schwecke was a retired engineer with the Seattle City Light that worked on the Cedar Falls project, and he loved hydro, and So when we found out about it, we contacted him, and he was delighted to be the engineer on the Holden Hydro project. And when he saw the units, you know, he said, well, this might be more difficult than it appears, because there's a lot of rodent damage to the wires. There's things missing from the governors. You know, we'll have to machine these things. And I said, do you know who could machine them? He said, well, I can machine them, because he had his own shop in Wenatchee in his basement of his house. And I said, well, you know, are you interested or aren't you? And he said, yeah, I'm interested. Because right at that time, he had found out that he had bid on putting in the hydro plant up in Stehekin. And he was just an individual. And, of course, the plant in Stehekin was owned by the Schlan PUD. And when he put in his bid, which was considerably under the others, they didn't accept it because he was an individual and he didn't have the background in construction that the other outfit had. And just a short time before that, they'd completed the project up there, and they threw the switch and it didn't work. And Henry was delighted. And so he said, when we contacted him about this one, he said, I want to do this project because I want to prove to the PUD that I can do it. And he did it. I mean, when ours started up, he threw the switch and, you know, the lights came on. And he made parts for it. He basically was here to guide all the volunteers. All the concrete that was mixed for the base of that was made with a little, I think they're calling them half sack, you know, home mixers that our volunteers worked with, you know, almost 24 hours a day to keep the concrete coming, or the cement coming into the forms and so forth. And Henry, we didn't actually have to pay him that much, because he had his folks at Homestead at 160 acres over above in Canoe Creek, which is right across the lake. And he was putting in a little hydro plant over there, so he said he'll make us a deal that, you know, we paid him some, but he said, if you'll send people over there to help me lay the pipe for my hydro plant, we'll exchange, you know, work over there for work here. So I would take, you know, a group of four or five guys over to work with him for a day, and then he would come, and he had his own boat, and he would come and work on our project. And so, you know, in a year, we had an operating hydro plant, and then we extended. But, I mean, Henry Schwecke was, you know, one of the miracle workers that really allowed Holden to operate. Walt Jesernick was another one. He was Pasco, Washington, and he was a contract manager for a large steel firm that did projects in South America and all over. And when he retired, he heard about Holden Village, and he came up and was involved in it. And the first winter we were up here, Joe Walmer and his wife Ruth weren't here the full winter, but they were here much of it. And he was a mechanic, and basically allowed the rest of us who were here to survive. And Murray and Horty Christman, some of you know them if you were around in the early days. His picture is in the museum on the steps. Many of those were pictures I took. And Horty he was known as the philosopher of the village, because he was, he only had an eighth grade education. He was a logger, a horse with horses. He grew up in a log cabin. He was a professional barber. And when he was here, he gave haircuts to not only the volunteers, but the bishops of the church. You know, they all wanted a haircut from Horty Christman. And so he was one of these, again, marvelous people that I think set the tone for Holden, that Holden wouldn't be what it is without Horty Christman. He was just a great person. Omer Klein was another one. That he was an HR director for a large corporation in Salt Lake City. And he had gone through a divorce, and he was pretty lonely, and heard about Holden and wanted to know if he could come up here. And so for the next, I don't know, 6-7 years, he was a volunteer up here and did a lot of our landscaping and so forth. And also, I don't know if Jeff remembers our son, but Omer was sort of his surrogate grandfather. In fact, I had a little problem. I don't know if I ever told Jeff. Where's Jeff? Is he
over here?
But Omer, somehow Omer and Jeff was, I don't know, 2 years old, maybe three, I don't know, and you know, we, as a family, when we were up here, we always said the evening meal we'd always eat together, because we never, you know, saw the kids the rest of the day, but we said the evening meal we'd always eat together. And so we'd eat together, and as soon as the evening meal was over, Jeff would get up from the table, run over to Omar, crawl up on his lap, and they would sit there and talk and play. And Omar always had a little box of toys, you know, a little caterpillar and a grater and so forth. And you know, and at first I really was jealous, because I thought, you know, that should be my task. I mean, he should jump in my lap. I should have the little grater and so forth. And then I thought, what a marvelous thing this is, that Jeff, who never knew either one of his grandfathers, you know, now has a surrogate grandfather, which, and this story repeated over and over up here for many, many people. Many of the volunteers that came up here, and especially in the early days, sometimes came up that were, you know, mad at their parents, and they didn't want anything to do with their families. And they would come up here and find a Horty Christman, or they would find, you know, somebody else that would, in a sense, become a surrogate grandparent for them. And the retired people that were up here, it was marvelous for them to, you know, to be able to be a surrogate grandparent for these kids that were, you know, in a sense, in their rebellious years, that were looking for some direction. Another one of these marvelous people was Al Swihart. Again, if any of you were up here during those days, you'd remember Al Swihart. I talked to somebody today, for who it was, that asked who was the person. Oh, it was Dave Olson, I think, wanted to know who the person was that sold cherries out of the golf cart. And that was Al Swihart. And Al was a volunteer. He and his wife were up here. His wife was really on the teaching staff. And he was involved in the lawns and so forth up here, but he always drove the cart. And he was a guy that actually was on Truth and Consequences, you know, the old TV show. Most of you, well, some of you are young enough to remember that. But he for many years was an operator of one of the, I can't remember, it was the VFW club or one of the clubs in Oklahoma City, a very large club, and he was like an entertainer. That he knew many of the poems by memory from Robert Service, and in fact, when we opened the lift down here, that he would often come down there and he would just recite Robert Service poems. And when he died a number of years ago, his wife Jean gave me his volume of the original, his of the complete works of Robert Service, which now Jeff has, because I'm liquidating a lot of stuff. So he's the recipient of that. But Al Swart was another one of these guys. He was the one that was worried about all the chipmunks here, the ground squirrels. And so he had a live trap, or we got a live trap for him, and he would live trap them, and then he would take them down to 10 Mile in the golf cart and release them down there. And one day he came to me and says, I think they're coming back. He said, I'm sure I recognize them. But, so he started putting a little dab of paint on their head, and he would take them down to 10 Mile, and sure enough, almost before he got back, he would see the little guy with the red. So he would take them down to 7 Mile, and they'd come back. I don't remember that he ever took them down to Lucerne, but finally we decided that, you know, chipmunks, this is their home. They want to be here, and they certainly have invaded, so. You know, there, it just sort of goes on and on. The Howard and Loretta Gilling are another couple that if some of you were here, especially in the winter, that Loretta for many years started baking cookies in like September. I mean, these were cookies that had real butter, real everything in them. And she would freeze them and then bring them up for Christmas. They came for Christmas every year for many years. Howard was the accountant for Holden for many years, and he just died a couple of years ago. Loretta's still living. But they were marvelous, generous. For many years, I think they had made the largest financial contribution to Holden of any individual or couple. And just a marvelous couple that did so much. Dorothy Bennett, who you know, started the lapidary shop. And is the lapidary shop still open?
Are you using it? It's still there, but it needs some repair.
Oh, yeah.
To get going again.
Well, she was again a marvelous person that fit Holden so well, that She was the superintendent of the Educational Service District, I think, with her offices in Everett. And after her husband died and she retired, she decided she was going to get rid of her house. She was not going to have anything that wouldn't fit in her car because she wanted to be free to travel, and she didn't want any storage space or anything. And she started coming up to Holden, and then part of the liquidation for her was getting rid of her lapidary things. And she said, well, do you want a lapidary shop? And we said, well, will you come up and operate it for us? And she said, yeah, I'd love to. And so for many summers after that, she would come up each year. And I remember when she first arrived in the village with this lapidary shop, she was the most organized person that I've ever seen before or after. And she had, I don't know, maybe 40 boxes that she had packed all this material in. And each one was numbered. And then she had a map where each box was to be set when it was unloaded in the basement of Chalet 1. And again, for many years, she operated the lapidary shop and she was tragically killed in an accident some years ago. But was another one of the great people that came through. But there's one person that I guess I'd sort of like to honor tonight, and that's Ron Vignac. And I don't know if we used to call him Ron Vignier, but I think it was actually Ron Vignac. And I don't know if any of you remember him, but I think it really personifies for me what Holden is all about and what the church should be all about. And one time Carol was in New York City, promoting Holden Village and so forth. And I can't remember the details, but somehow Ron was a teenager. I think he was 18 or he wouldn't have been up here on the staff. But he found Ron, and his mother was raising Ron. His grandmother, Ron's grandmother, was raising him. And she was very concerned about Ron, that he was out on the streets and was going to get mixed in the wrong crowd and so forth. And I think the grandmother talked to Carol and said, is this Holden Village? She didn't know anything about Holden Village, but is that any place that Ron could go? So Carol helped bring Ron, encouraged him to come out to Holden Village. And he stayed here that summer and really got involved in Holden and loved it and so forth. And he really didn't want to go back to New York City, and he didn't really, had never thought of going to college. And I can remember it was in the spring of 1965, because I was still single at the time, and I had rented an apartment in the University District in Seattle. And I was gonna, in the early days, we had the office here in the summertime and then in Seattle in the wintertime. And then Ron came along and he wanted to move to Seattle but didn't have a place to live. And I said, well, I've got this apartment, and my brother was actually interning at the time at Harborview in Seattle. And so I said, I can go stay with my brother. You take my apartment and stay there. So he stayed in that apartment, and he worked at a Greasy Spoon restaurant in the U District for part of that year. And then through Holden, and I don't know the exact details, but Holden was able, and I assume it was partially through Carol's contacts, and I was able to get a scholarship to a college. And so Ron went to college 4 years and then went on to seminary, to Luther Seminary. And so, you know, all this started, you know, because he was able to come to Holden Village. And Ron, he had such a big heart and such great compassion, and he was such a humble person that I guess that too often people get started and they go into the ministry, and too often they think in terms of big church, important position, maybe I become the bishop someday. That wasn't Ron. He started a ministry after he got out of the seminary. He started a ministry in Tacoma, Washington, and I think he was in the same ministry for 30 or 35 years. And it was to a low-income housing development in Tacoma, and to the homeless and to the addicts. And he stayed in this ministry for, I think, the whole 35 years. He just retired, I think, recently. And and he was hardly paid anything. But this was his ministry, and I'm sure that part of the reason that he was there was because of his experience in New York City and, you know, seeing what the streets can do to people. Part of his experience was here at Holden Village. But he stayed in a ministry that I think is what the ministry should all be about and what Holden should all be about. So I guess I'd like to honor Ron tonight. And I haven't seen him. The last time I saw him was in the SeaTac airport, and he was meeting his wife. He married a volunteer person from Holden Village. And even this was to me a miracle or unusual, because the Nancy, I can't remember, Nancy Olson, I think was her name. And her father was an engineer with Boeing, I think, and a very successful engineer. And they lived on Mercer Island, so that, there was a real disconnect between the lifestyle of Ron Vignette and the lifestyle of the Olsons. And yet they got together, and they're still together. You know, beautiful marriage, beautiful family. But to me, this is, in a sense, what Holden has done for so many people over the years. And I think Ron, I mean, there's many people that I think, you know, had this experience, but I think Ron is one that for me, and I haven't seen him very often since that time, but, you know, I keep remembering, you know, how fragile he was, in a sense, when he came up here and was, willing to be involved, and then stayed with a ministry that I think really honors what he found here at Holden. So, sorry, I got a little carried away, but anyway, I guess we have a few minutes left, and since this is sort of the last opportunity, I'll have to share stories that maybe some of you have some questions, or if you've heard something that you want either explained, or anybody have a question? Yes.
Well, the village has such a huge infrastructure.
I'm sort of hard hearing, so I'm sorry.
Me too. I've always been puzzled because the village is so big. Everything they built, those 100 houses that have gone up the road there at Winston and everything else, did they really expect to be able to mine for much longer? Did they know what they were getting into?
No, from what I was told and what I've read is that prior to the operation of the mine, that they did all the exploratory drillings, and their analysis was that they could operate 20 years, and I can't remember, but I think they said that in order for them to start the mine operation, they'd have to be somewhat assured of a 20-year operation, and I think it was a 10% return on their money. It was not a very big return on their money, and when the work was done by House Sound, that's what they came up with. They said, you know, this mine will last 20 years and you'll get, and I think it was 10%. It was either 5, 7, or 10, something like that, so take your pick. If you retell the story, you can decide. And so they did. They went ahead with the operation, and it lasted 20 years. And it came out exactly whatever percentage they had anticipated. So they were satisfied with the operation. But during the operation, they, of course, like any organization, had a lot of setbacks. The one time they decided that instead of putting all the tailings out in the ponds here, that they were going to pump them back into the mine, partially to stabilize the mine. And because there's over 50 miles of tunnel that they blasted out of copper base or a copper mine. And so they started pumping the tailings back in a slurry, just like they pumped them out. And then they put a bulkhead in, and at some point the bulkhead let loose and it flooded the whole lower sections of the mine, and it took them, I think, over a year to clean it up, which meant that they weren't really deriving any money during that time, and that was a real setback. Another one during the Second World War, the government was, you know, during the war years, was getting very low on copper for, all the planes that were being built and electronics and so forth. And so they said, they asked House Sound Company to go ahead and explore Copper Basin. And House Sound had done some core drillings in Copper Basin to determine if there was another ore body over there. And they thought they had detected some, so the government, as I understand it, paid like half cost of digging over into Copper Basin. And they got over there, and once they got there, they didn't find anything that was worth mining. So I was actually in the mine a couple times, and the engineer showed us the tunnel that went over to Copper Basin that was at that point was then, you know, sealed off. So the mine, but they did. They made their 20 years, they made their percentage they were looking at, and they were, you know, willing to close down at that point. So any other questions, or somebody wants to argue with me, or?
Was there a period of time where the housing was empty? There was a gap?
It was, I think the mine closed in like June of 57. And then Wes wrote the letters, you know, in the 57, 58, 59. And during that time, Oscar Getty was hired by the mining company. He was the owner of the land down at Lucerne. And he was hired by the mining company to be the caretaker, basically, or the watch person. And of course, none of you knew Oscar Getty. I don't think I did. And he was not a guard or a watch person. He had a corn cob in his mouth almost continuously, and he was very soft spoken. And he was, I think, a little bit shorter than I am. Wonderful guy. And but during that time, the resort, which was, you know, losing a lot of money after the mine closed down, there was a resort down there that had at cabins and a restaurant and a tavern and so forth. And maybe they were associated with the brothel, which we won't talk about anymore. Oscar, or the resort then, started advertising that, you know, come up to Lucerne and stay here, and then we'll take you up to the old ghost town, and then you can get souvenirs out of it. So there was a period of time when Lucerne Resort would bring people up here, and like these captain's chairs that you're sitting on, probably half of those disappeared and are at various houses down the lake and in Chelan and Wenatchee and maybe Seattle too. Maybe some of the churches over there. So there was that period of time from like 57 to basically 61. And in 1960, you know, some of the people from Wenatchee that were, you know, after Wes got the letters into the hands of LBI, then Lutheran Bible Institute, then they started coming up here and doing surveys, exploring, and starting the process. And Wes was here for, in fact, on one of the lectures that Jeff recorded and gave me a CD on. I mean, it was a lecture I had interviewed Wes many years ago, and it was a beautiful sunny day, and I looked up and I thought I saw the Lord giving the hand of blessing, or when he was in Alaska, it was a beautiful sunny day. It was always a beautiful sunny day for us. That was part of his marvelous. Anyway, he was up here and he tells stories that, you know, people would come up the road and you know, he would tell them that this is private property now and they couldn't take things you know, so if some things disappeared and there was some vandalism. I remember when I first came up here, it was after the forerunners, and they said that they had counted 9,000 panes, you know, the little panes of windows that had been broken out that needed to be replaced. I don't know if they actually counted those or if that was an estimate, but maybe there aren't even 9,000 panes up here. But there was some vandalism done, but basically the village was in good shape, so which made it possible to basically start an operation almost immediately. And I mean, the water worked. There was no power. There was no heat in any of the buildings. In 1963, when I came up here on a volunteer basis, that fortunately I was managing the kitchen, and I had a room directly above the kitchen for a while. And the only heat in any of the buildings was the kitchen, because at that time they were still using the stoves from the mine, and they were old. I think they were old ship stoves that were powered by diesel fuel that had a burner at one end of the stove, and they had thick metal grills and then the ovens, and so that Reuben Thompson, who was the maintenance person up here when we first started, he would get up at 5 in the morning and start these oil. I mean, it's the same thing basically as in hot water heaters, but they were big blowers that, you know, heated up. And of course, that heated up the upstairs, but that was the only place where there was heat. And that's really why Koinonia got started, is that in 1963, it was such a cold summer up here and it was rainy. And, you know, people would come and they didn't have any heat in any of their rooms. There wasn't heat in the village center. You know, I mean, we all wore coats for Vespers. And so we decided at that point that we had to have something like a hotel lobby for people to sit in. And it so happened that that summer, I think it was in the late August of 1963, that the youth board of, I think, the American Lutheran Church came up here as a board to see Holden and also have their meeting. And one of the guys that was carrying his child around, we got talking with him, and it happened that he was an architect. And his wife was on the board, so he was just babysitting while his wife was at the meetings. And Willis Shelberg was his name, from Forest City, Iowa. And he said that we said that what we had in mind, that we wanted a building with a hotel lobby. And at that time, Lodge 5, that had been a dormitory during the mining years, was partially dismantled. The salvage crew that had been in here had taken out a lot of the fixtures, taken all the wall boards off and so forth. The old liquor distribution part of the mine was right in this corner. It was like two rooms, and the mine didn't allow any liquor to be sold in here. You had to order it through the mine, and then the mine would order it, and then they would distribute it. And they had a very, very strong desire to make sure that liquor wasn't a problem in the community. And so that they had a rule that if anyone was seen in public that was inebriated, there was automatic dismissal from your job and from the community. You had to go down Lake. There was no questions asked. And I was mentioning it to Bob and some others this afternoon that the things that they were concerned about was religion, gambling, and liquor. And they took care of the liquor partially by distributing it themselves. Gambling, they said there could be no professional gamblers in the village unless they worked underground in the mine. And then they could be here, but they couldn't be here for gambling. And they said the same thing with pastors, that no pastor could come up here and have religious service unless they worked in the mine. And that was the way they controlled it. You know, I mean, it was a company town. So, I mean, they literally owned, you know, the activities. I can't remember what story I was starting on, but
how we got the fireplace.
Oh yeah, right. And anyway, Willis Shelberg, then he agreed to, on a volunteer basis, to design a building for us, and which was this building. And he sent us plans out, and we told him what we had in mind. We said, you know, we wanted a place for conversation. And we wanted to make sure that it was a conversational place and not a meeting room in a sense. And so that's why he came up with a round fireplace. There was a beautiful hood here at one point. It always breaks my heart that it's not there. And he had a second drawing of another fireplace that was located at the end of the room, just like a typical fireplace, you know, like in a lodge and so forth. And I went back to Forest City, Iowa, and met with him and said, well, we've picked this design. And he said, well, that's good, because he said, if you wouldn't have picked the design, I wouldn't have finished the plans for you, because this is the only one that would do what you asked me to do. And so this was designed, and this was built first, it was finished in 1966. And you know, the hood and everything. And then the back part of Koinonia was worked on after that, and at one point, we had a library, which was half of the room, not like it is now. The other half was the mine museum. And then the upstairs wasn't finished at that time, but Carol had invited Roland Baton, who is a Luther scholar from Yale University, and you know, was a world-renowned lecturer and so forth. And the only way that Carol could get him to come out was that Roland wanted to have his family join him here, because he had just gotten back from Japan on a speaking engagement, so the family was going to meet Roland here. And we found out about this, you know, like a half a year in advance, and part of it was that we'd have to have housing for him so that their family and he could stay together and be sort of somewhat separated. So we quickly finished the rooms upstairs, which are no longer there, and and so that was, in a sense, finished for lodging for Roland Baton and his family. Of course, after that, it was used for housing, too, but in a lot of sense, that's how things happened around here, is that out of necessity, we did certain things either to encourage somebody to come or to accommodate somebody or to allow, like this was a hotel lobby where, you know, during the cold days, people come and sit around the fireplace. And one reason why Willis Shelberg designed it this way is that he didn't want this to be a meeting area where there would be chairs lined up in rows. I mean, it sort of still fits that, but not quite, you know. And there was problems with the hood did have some problems with smoking once in a while, and so I understand why they took it out, but it still it was a great part of for Holden Village as I was concerned. And I guess I can quickly go on to another story that relates to the hood, that relates to Koinonia and the fireplace, that if some of you were here in the early days, that we used to have auctions to raise money. Now, one thing that Carol said when he first got up here, we were not going to use Holden Village to raise money from people that were captive here. That was an agreement that we had, and we weren't going to, you know, do that. Well, Wald Olson was a wonderful electrician from Seattle, and his family knew about Holden. Walt had a problem with alcohol, and they said, "Will you accept Walt to come up and, you know, if you need an electrician, he'll come up on a volunteer basis and be your electrician and do what you can to help him with his addiction." And so Walt came up, and wonderful, wonderful guy. I don't think we helped him, but he was here for a couple of years. And I think it was help, but maybe not totally. Anyway, one in the early part of 1966, we'd finished the Koinonia, except then the fire of the hood was coming from Teeter Sheet Metal in Seattle, I remember, and it was a 7-foot hood and a huge thing. And I think at that time, you know, it cost $1,500, which was a lot of money. And Walt came up to me and he said, "You know, Holden doesn't have that kind of money to buy this thing, and it's coming up on the barge today. You're going to get the bill, and how are you going to pay for it?" And I said, "Well, I don't know. We'll figure out something." And he said, "Well," he reached into his wallet, he pulled out a $100 bill, and he said, "Well," this was 4th of July, in fact, and he said that you get up at the microphone this noon and you hold this $100 bill and you say, "We need 15 more people or 14 more people to give us a $100 bill so that we can pay for the hood today." And, you know, I told Walt, "We don't do this here." And he was so insistent that I finally went to Carol and said, "You know, Walt wants me to do this. I know it's against our policy, but, you know, should we do it?" And he said, Carol said, "Yeah, go ahead and try it." And so I got up to the microphone, held up the $100 bill, and within 5 minutes we had $1,500. And you know, and then I said, "Well, gee, you know, this is working pretty well." And I said, "We also have to pay for a carpet." And so in another five minutes we had a total of $2,400. And that sort of set the stage for, you know, this happened. Then I think for 5 or 6 Fourth of Julys after that, we started having a larger crowds here, and we had, you know, a big Fourth of July celebration in the Village Center with a talent show and so forth. And at the intermission, I would get up and we would have a project going. So we bought the sawmill that's still in operation through one of these auctions. We bought the greenhouse, which is no longer here, through one of these auctions. The grand piano, which I don't think this is it anymore. It was a 8 or 9 foot grand piano that we bought, and that was bought through one of these auctions and a snowmobile. The most we ever raised like that was $1,250, and again, it was all. I mean, it was people loved it. I can still remember in the Village Center that the enthusiasm was so great that. It, you know, we almost have to say, "Okay, the auction is over, no more. Don't give anything else, because, you know, it's over." And I think the grand piano that we bought was like $10,000, and it was coming from Salt Lake City. And so we did the $10,000, then we had $2,500 left over to help pay for a down payment on a snowmobile. So, I mean, these are the type of things that occurred that were sort of spontaneous, but allowed the village to do some of these things. Anyway, it's time to quit, and it's great to share stories, and God, you can be here, so.
Yeah, thank you.